I'm Joanne Nesty. Every night at this time, Chris takes a look with you at life in and around New England. We're in the May issue of Connecticut Magazine. And here's a story called Forgotten Connecticut. Across the state, abandoned and long-lost sites still hold stories of bygone eras. Here's a look at four of them. It's written by Andrew DeRosa and Abby Weiss. And it starts with Hearthstone Castle in Danbury. Up a steep incline from Brushy Hill Road, a castle lost to time overlooks one of Danbury's most popular parks. Surrounded by black gravel, high fences, and a bevy of thorns, Hearthstone Castle in Terry Weil Park is abandoned. However, work to restore the property could lead to a second life for the castle that was once teeming with neoclassical design elements, stained glass windows, and wealthy occupants. Over the past 4 years, the city of Danbury is estimated to have invested at least $1.1 million of work into the rehabilitation of Hearthstone Castle, according to Antonio Iadarola, who is Danbury's director of public works and the city engineer. For years, he says, you couldn't get a feeling for this castle because there was so much debris. But now I can bring the mayor into the basement of this building, and we can stand there and look at this beautiful structure from the bottom up. Built between 1895 and 1899, the castle was designed by famed architect Ernest Dietrich, who is credited with designing the first craftsman-style home, featured in furniture designer Gustav Stickley's Craftsman magazine. Dietrich built the castle for Danbury-based photographer Elias Starr Sanford and his wife, who initially referred to it as the Sanford Castle, according to the archives at Western Connecticut State University. After owning the house for 5 years, the Sanfords sold the castle to Victor Buck, a retired industrialist who renamed it Buck's Castle. In 1918, 8 years after purchasing the nearby Terry Weil Mansion, Charles Darling Parks purchased the castle from the Buck family as a wedding gift for his daughter, according to the Terry Weil Mansion. After Parks purchased the castle, it was renamed Hearthstone. At its peak, the house contained 17 rooms and had multiple fireplaces, stained glass panels, two libraries, and a music room. Heirs of the Parks family resided there until the late 1980s before they sold it. Terry Weil Mansion, Terry Weil Mansion and the adjoining land to the city of Danbury. The castle was named to the National Register of Historic Places shortly after in 1987, and it remains in the care of the city of Danbury to this day. The process of clearing out the castle, though, has involved removing old debris from the roof that fell into the belly of the building, as well as the abatement of the walls of the structure after the discovery of asbestos. Iadarola says the castle has been, as he puts it, stabilized, and it is now safer for crews to work on the property, but it remains closed off to the public by a fence surrounding the perimeter. According to Iadarola, the city is still envisioning what the next phase could look like for Hearthstone Castle. Various ideas have been tossed around, including the castle becoming a destination point that could include an area to grab lunch while exploring the 722-acre park. The park has some great trails, Iadarola says, and they go through the numerous acres that we have there. And to have this as a destination point was something that we were interested in doing. The recent endeavors to restore the castle come after years of uncertainty surrounding the property. In 2008, a task force known as the Hearthstone Castle Task Force, which no longer exists, according to Iadarola, was formed to brainstorm some ways to preserve the property, but 8 years later, voters in Danbury approved a bond package that included the partial demolition of Hearthstone, which caused controversy and prompted a discussion between city and state officials over its preservation. Next is Fairy Village, quote-unquote, in Waterbury. Tucked away off an access road in Middlebury and just over the town line in Waterbury, city line, is a hidden village that is said to have housed little fairies and even elves. Whether by some form of magic or just strong infrastructure, structures from this village have stood the test of time and they remain among the rugged landscape. The abandoned, quote-unquote, fairy village, or the little people's village, as it's become affectionately referred to, is a short walk from Old Waterbury Road. The road itself is small, and the nearest parking lot is at a Maggie McFly's restaurant, approximately half a mile from the entrance of the park to the village. Traversing well-paved path at the end of Old Waterbury Road, the village can be reached in 5 minutes. Graffiti and weathered stone structures greet visitors. Small buildings and miniature caves remain, while some of the chimneys protrude from the rocky area. According to Robert Rafford, president of the Middlebury Historical Society, the real story behind the abandoned ferry village is, as he puts it, boring. "I don't like to splash cold water on people's fantasies and ideas," Rafford says. "This is a fun thing for people." But Rafford says that Old Waterbury Road used to be the main access road between Middlebury and Waterbury, but it was bypassed in 1928. In his findings, published in an edition of Middlebury Neighbors, Rafford discovered that rubber plant worker William Joseph Lannan wanted to profit from the influx of travel on Straits Turnpike and the surrounding area, so he bought land in 1924 where he built a gasoline station. When 1928 came around and improvements came to Middlebury Road, his gas station was no longer on the major road and had been relegated to a side road. So in 1934, Lannan transformed his site into a nursery, complete with tiny handmade structures made out of concrete, metal, and other materials. There were houses, a church, and even a lighthouse in the village. At the onset of World War II in 1939, Lannan abandoned his nursery, and he died in 1958, and the property was sold to a relative. There have been many so-called supernatural rumors about this property that have come up over time, such as that on nights with a full moon, one can hear the elves laughing, or that fantastical creatures convinced Lannan to build the property. Rafford says that he has never been able to substantiate any of these supernatural stories, but he admits that in his 22 years as the municipal historian in town, he has received the most calls about the abandoned ferry village. Now, a project from the Connecticut Transportation Department may threaten the existence of the village. According to Josh Morgan, the state DOT communications director, a project to make safety improvements, as they're called, is in the design phase for the area. Morgan says it's too early to say whether the village will be impacted, and there is no timeline for construction. Uncertainty from the state has not quelled Rafford's fear that the village could be demolished with the construction. With all the vehicles and equipment that it will take to build this off-ramp and on-ramp, he says, "I think that probably the whole area will be pretty well demolished." Rafford believes that the site, as he puts it, merits some kind of memorialization, and he's hoping that someone takes action to save the site in some capacity. Next is Holy Land in Waterbury, which you may have spotted from the highway. Overlooking downtown Waterbury and I-84, a 56-foot LED cross is the centerpiece of the Holy Land property, a now-defunct religious theme park that attracted thousands when it was active for almost three decades, starting in the 1950s. After it closed in 1984, the property sat in various states of dormancy, but for Waterbury priest Reverend Jim Sullivan, he believes that there is still more to come in the story of the Holy Land. Sullivan is the rector at the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception in Waterbury and says he has been invested in the Holy Land property since he can remember. He has attended city meetings since the 1980s to see what will become of the property, and he now serves on the board of directors that oversees it. Holy Land is operated by a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, and it is run by that board of directors. Though no definite plans have been made regarding reconstruction efforts for the roughly 18-acre property, Father Sullivan, who owned a contracting business for 25 years before being ordained a priest at the age of 53, says that a few ideas have been suggested that he hopes will be implemented. Some of those ideas include a new parking lot with easier access to the Hamilton Avenue exit on I-84, and landscaping the land around the Holy Land USA sign to include staircases up to the cross. Each step in the staircase would symbolize one of the Hail Mary prayers in the rosary, according to Father Sullivan. Among the LED cross, which replaced the original cross, there are still remnants of the original theme park on the property, which was conceived by Waterbury-based attorney John Greco in the 1950s. It still includes replicas of biblical sites in Bethlehem and Jerusalem, albeit in a state of decay. If renovations were to occur at Holy Lands, Father Sullivan says he hopes that many of the original structures will be kept. Because of those abandoned structures, though, the property has been viewed as a timepiece of a bygone era. Sullivan says that spending time on the property will change anyone's mind about Holy Land being an abandoned or forgotten place. One or two experiences of coming up here and seeing the beauty and the potential, Sullivan says, I think will dispel the darkness. Holy Land is still used today for Mass and other Catholic traditions. Sullivan says he held his first Mass at Holy Land in 2018. I called the mayor's office, he says, and they immediately said yes. It was the first time we had a Mass up here, Sullivan says. He adds that the first Mass drew approximately 1,100 people in the pouring rain. The most recent Mass held on the property was the annual Easter Sunday sunrise service, which took place this past March 31st. In April, Ruins of a Holy Land, a photography exhibit in New Haven by Joy Bush, featured a collection of photographs taken of Holy Land USA by Bush since the late 1980s. Talks of the restoration of Holy Land happened to coincide with the beatification of Michael McGivney, a Waterbury native who founded the Knights of Columbus. Beatification is one step before canonization of Father McGivney into the Catholic sainthood. For me, Sullivan says, this is a special place because I have a feeling he will be canonized. If he were canonized a saint, I have a feeling that the restoration of Holy Land, whatever that means or will also be a place of pilgrimage because of him. And next, the ghost parking lot in Hamden. When longtime Hamden resident Tony Griego discusses the Starbucks drive-thru at Hamden Plaza, he mentions two notable features, the traffic jams during busy hours and the elevation of the land that it sits on. The Starbucks is lower than the main parking lot, 81-year-old Griego says. And that's because, he says, 20 years ago, dozens of asphalt-covered cars were excavated from that location, creating a deeper ground for the drive-thru, which opened in 2022. This was the site of the Hamden Ghost parking lot, a famous art installation that commented on America's car and consumer culture. The piece, designed by Emilio Sousa and site founder James Wines, S-I-T-E, was installed in 1978 and consisted of 20 cars buried in asphalt at the front of the lot along Dixwell Avenue. It was demolished in 2003. Griego, who has lived in Hamden his whole life, remembers reporters and customers swarming the installation when it was first completed. Hamden residents eventually got used to the sight of it over the years. It was something that was unique to Hamden, he says, probably unique to our country. David Berment, the founder of Hamden Plaza, commissioned the Hamden Ghost Parking Lot. He was an avid art collector and commissioned public art for his center starting in the 1960s. Andrew Berment, his son and the current plaza owner, says, donated station wagons and convertibles from the 1950s to early 1970s were shipped to the plaza to create it. My father believed that art should be enjoyed by the masses, not just kept in a museum, Berment says. He was a big believer of particularly art that stimulated thought and spoke about society in some way. Wines told the New York Times in 2003 that the concept of the ghost parking lot tackled multiple aspects of American society, including its dependency on cars and fossil fuels. Berment says the concept spoke to both the current and future state of America's car-oriented society. These cars are buried under asphalt, he says, and it looks like they're rising up from the dead. It's kind of paying homage to our vehicle-based society and the future, where eventually cars will probably become outdated and outmoded. Maybe we won't survive, and the cars will just deteriorate, he says. The piece did deteriorate, though, over the following 25 years due to weather and skateboarders who used it as ramps. And in 2003, Hamden Plaza Associates demolished the installation after advocates failed to raise enough money to preserve it. I always thought it would be one of the things that would last forever in the town of Hamden, but over the years, you could see it start to deteriorate, Griego says. Every time it rained, it saturated the metalwork, and it was just becoming an eyesore. Wines and Berman, who had taken over the business from his father, had no interest in preserving the installation. Berman says Wines told him that the piece's gradual demise was intentional and encompasses the message of the artwork. Everything humans build will eventually deteriorate. He had a vision, Berman says, and as much as it became an eyesore for some people, it still spoke to our society and to our civilization. A year after the piece's removal, Berman installed a plaque at the shopping center next to Marshall's, honoring the sculpture. He doesn't plan to follow in his dad's footsteps and commission more art pieces at Hamden Plaza, citing rising costs of operating shopping centers. When I'm at the shopping center, he says, I will bump into somebody who says, I remember when you had that ghost car parking lot here. It's amazing, he says. The story, which was called Forgotten Connecticut, was written by Andrew DeRosa and Abby Weiss for the May issue of Connecticut Magazine. Continuing now here on Living in New England, and maybe we'll stay with the theme of forgotten Connecticut sites, but this article called Past Lives takes a look at buildings that have been reused. Former banks, jails, and gasoline stations now house restaurants, giving the spaces new life. The story is written by Leanne Griffin. Guests walking into Mystic's Engine Room restaurant for burgers and bourbon immediately see a piece of the Seaside Village's maritime history. The casual restaurant displays one of the first single-cylinder marine engines built by the J.W. Lathrop Engine Company, which once occupied the Home Street building, where Dan Meiser's Rustic Casual Restaurant just marks its 10th anniversary. The Mystic economy, for most of its existence, was tied very closely to the sea and the marine trades, Meiser says. It's one of the reasons, the main reasons, people come to Mystic. So for us to be in a beautiful building and have a restaurant in there that has this rich history is something we really want to showcase and celebrate. Connecticut is full of repurposed restaurants, though, breweries too, other dining spots, all of which began life as other buildings. Diners can enjoy craft beer, tacos, and fine dining tastings in renovated former banks, mills, train stations, and post offices as restaurateurs got creative with decor and themed menus. Guests at a pub in the state's northeastern quiet corner in a former courthouse are treated to a so-called docket or menu with legal and penal-related items and terms. And wing lovers visiting former Windsor Fire Station can choose between 1 and 3 alarms for their preferred sauce heat level. Carrie Corella opened Harry's Jailhouse in Middletown with business partner Heather Kelly in the historic 1850s Pimicha Jail building in 2021, and says she had been attracted to the space in part because it had already housed a restaurant, the former Bread and Water. Though the previous eatery featured a fine dining menu and Harry specializes in sandwiches and snacks, Corella said it was helpful to move into the building with a kitchen that was already built out. They were particularly attracted to the building's basement, as they envisioned it becoming what now is Harry's cozy, intimate bar. And Corella claims she and the Harry staff definitely experience occasional paranormal activity in the approximately 175-year-old building, like doors closing unexpectedly, unexplained open windows, and flickering lights. It's not necessarily a bad energy, she says. It's just someone's there. We call her Sarah. We believe her to be a young girl. When she acts up, we pour her a little mocktail and leave it out on the windowsill behind the bar. It's like our version of a Shirley Temple, and things calm down after that. Here are some other noteworthy Connecticut eateries in unique, revamped spaces, starting with Taquerillo in Mystic, a former 1950s gas station. Offering hot tacos and cold margaritas, Taquerillo in Mystic sits in a restored station and repair shop, which was previously remodeled by the owners of M-Bar, its predecessor. In the warm months, Taquerio's garage bay doors open to let in fresh air with additional outdoor seating on the patio and underneath a canopy that once arched over the gasoline pumps. The menu features a variety of tacos with fillings like barbacoa, al pastor, carnitas, fried avocado, and grilled swordfish, along with classic, flavored, and frozen margaritas. Broken Symmetry in Bethel, housed in a former train depot. Broken Symmetry Gastro Brewery opened in Bethel in 2018 in the town's refurbished depot, offering 9 rotating drafts of its ales, lagers, IPAs, and sours, in addition to draft cocktails. The brewery's food menu features a changing selection of bar fare, intended to be fluid alongside the rotating taps, head of distribution and brand development Rachel Diamond told Hearst, Connecticut in 2023. Guests can expect bites like burgers, Korean arancini, crab toast, pierogi, and a giant pretzel with mustard and beer cheese dipping sauces. Marketplace Tavern in Litchfield in the former jail. Marketplace Tavern opened in 2019, and it retains features of the former penal institution, the Litchfield Jail, with jail cells overlooking the 3-story bar, and bars remaining on the windows that face the Litchfield Green. It was originally built in 1812 to serve as a jail for British prisoners during the War of 1812, according to the restaurant's website. In the early 1990s, it served as a treatment center for men serving prison sentences, then later as a rehabilitation center for women facing incarceration. Today, it's a spot for new American cuisine and craft cocktails, with dishes like buttermilk fried chicken, short rib poutine, and ahi tuna poke. Millwrights in Simsbury in a former grist and sawmill. Centuries before, James Beard Award nominee and Top Chef contestant Tyler Anderson opened his New England-inspired fine dining restaurant there. The Hopbrook Mill, built in 1680, was home to an active grist and sawmill. Today, the renovated restaurant looks out over a rushing waterfall with an upstairs loft, a first-floor dining room with floor-to-ceiling windows, and more tables on a newly built enclosed bridge over the waterfall, and a more casual basement-level tavern space. Executive chef Ashley Flagg lets the seasons guide the menu, according to Millwright's website, with ingredients from local farms showcasing global flavors like a marinated crab tostada with salsa maca crema or matcha crema, and a half chicken with local grits, braised mushrooms, and chili crunch. Twisted Vine in Derby in a former bank. This Derby restaurant, housed in the former Birmingham National Bank, built in 1892, is an apparent hotbed of paranormal activity, apparently. Flickering lights, unexplained moving furniture, the shadowy figure of a child. Norwalk-based Ghost Storm investigated the venue in 2019, and Twisted Vine ended up being named one of Food Network's most haunted restaurants in every state. The restaurant also appeared on a 2020 episode of the Travel Channel's Kindred Spirit. Twisted Vine's American Continental Fare leans heavily on Italian and pasta dishes, with some Asian and Pacific Rim influences. Twisted Vine hosts a full slate of paranormal events. Bank and Bridge Brewing in Mystic, in a former bank. The laid-back, culinary-forward brew pub, as described by owner Walt Bansley, opened in July of 2021 in a former bank building. From the outside, Bank and Bridge still looks like its former iteration, with a stately granite exterior and an entrance flanked by 4 columns. Its open and airy tap room features high ceilings and a long white bar stretching across the center of the room. Bright green palm fronds lend a warm beach vibe, as does the Cali Reggae soundtrack that Bansley, a San Diego native, favors. But even inside, its origins as a bank are obvious. Guests can even check out the vault to the left of the bar. The brewery has a full kitchen with beer-friendly cuisine like smash burgers, fried chicken sandwiches, hand-cut fries, wings, and pretzel bites with house-made beer cheese. Plan B Burger Bar in Simsbury, housed in a former train station. The former station was built in the 1870s, and Plan B's building was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1976, the year it opened and was known as One Way Fair. One Way ended its run in 2007, but a year later, the owners of Locals 8 restaurant group debuted their second Plan B burger bar in the space, bringing a menu of burgers, beer, and bourbon to the Farmington Valley town. After its inaugural location opened in West Hartford, Plan B has since expanded to Glastonbury, Hartford, Milford, Southington, and Springfield, Massachusetts. New Salem Brewing in Newtown, in a former psychiatric hospital. New Salem Brewing opened in 2020. In a building at what was formerly Fairfield Hills Hospital, a psychiatric facility on a 100-plus acre campus with more than a dozen buildings, the state operated Fairfield Hills from 1930 to 1995, according to New Salem's website. In 2004, the town of Newtown bought approximately 184 acres of the original property. The brewery space was once the staff dining room and later became the staff library. When asked whether the campus is haunted or not, we can only answer, we're not sure, according to the website. New Salem offers assorted varieties of its beer brewed on site, including its Counting the Days IPA, Therapy Session Pale Ale, Keating Farms Kolsch, and Turbo Encapsulator Doppelbock, along with food options like wood-fired pizza, giant pretzels, charcuterie boxes, and other snacks and desserts. Next, Lisa's Crown and Hammer in Collinsville, housed in a former rail cargo depot. Lisa's Crown and Hammer Pub is located in the former depot of the village's former Collins Company. The company was founded in 1826 and proved to be one of the most innovative edge tool manufacturers in the world, according to the Town of Canton website. Lisa's positions itself as a warm and historic building, filled with memories of the town's beginnings, offering pub-style fare like French onion soup, burgers, wings, salads, and entrees like scallops and bacon, New York strip steak, baked cod, and chicken piccata. The Courthouse in Putnam. It's in a former courthouse. Putnam Bar and Grill was indeed built as the town's courthouse in 1889, according to its website, and the building's downstairs space was home to a series of businesses, including a soda fountain shop, a grocery store, and a paint store. James Frost and his wife Sheila have owned the casual restaurant since 1998, with its menu, or docket, categories nodding to legal terms like opening statements for the appetizers, felonious fowl, bailiff's beef, illegal seafood, and juvenile hall for the kids' menu. And the Tavern at Gray Barns in Norwalk is in a former textile factory on the Silver Mine River. Built in the 1920s, upper-level dining room looks out over the river, and chefs pick produce from the on-site garden. And that's tonight's look at life in and around New England. I'm Joanne Nesting. Thank you for listening.